That's better. In the desert outside Las Vegas, in the shot of the Anasazi, on a glowing, gorgeous, fierce slab of red rock, are two people, a man and a woman. And they are standing like this, with their bodies completely outstretched, their hands outstretched, and from their feet are streaming jagged lightning, the lightning of the awakened spirit. So I would like us all at the beginning of this time together to really stretch out, to stretch out to the invisible sun that is our source, to feel it coursing down our bodies and leaping in our veins, and to imagine being that man or that woman, absolutely full, absolutely complete, saying a huge yes to the whole of experience and to the whole adventure of transformation.
Yes!
Yes! Just hold it for a minute in silence and let that yes ring far more loudly than any words could let it. And then think about what you're doing. You've got two hands up. So it's yes for the dark as well as the light. It's yes for agony as well as joy. It's yes for the earth as well as heaven. It's yes for the no as well as the yes. It's yes for both together. The marriage of opposites. And that is what you are affecting in your being with that yes and through that yes. So let's have another yes. Yes! And afterwards we'll do gym together. Are you feeling alive?
Yes.
Because I am, and I want this to be a very lively and wild session, because for me, the truth is both lively and wild, as you will see. But first, let me fling out into the room a magnificent story from Al-Ghazali. One day, Jesus saw a group of people squatting disconsolately on a wall by the side of the road. And he asked them, "Why do you look so miserable?" And they groaned, "The fear of hell has made us like this." Jesus went on his way and came to another group who were also sitting dejectedly by the side of the road. And he asked them, "Why are you so unhappy?" And they wept, "The longing for paradise has made us like this." Jesus went on walking until he came to a third group. And these were people who had evidently suffered a great deal, but their faces were bright with joy. And Jesus asked them, "What has made you so joyful?" They smiled, "The spirit of truth itself. We have seen reality and turned away from all lesser goals." And Jesus said, "People like these are the ones who attain the one. And on the day of reckoning, it will be people like these who stand in the presence of God." I have discovered in my own experience that what the authentic mystical path demands is a mysterious, paradoxical balance between wildness and humility. Between the wildness that risks the adventure at all moments, that sets sails into unknown seas, that risks extreme fragility, vulnerability, the smashing of all your agendas, the smashing of all of your certainties, the setting out yet again into sea after sea of blood, the embrace of terror. This wildness can't be faked. You can't pretend it. You have to find it. You have to uncover it. And you have to release it. You have to find it and uncover it in the core of your heart's wild, passionate longing for the supreme experience of divine passion. And you have to uncover it in your soul's primordial longing to be one with the one. And you have to uncover it in the cells of your own body that are thirsting to be born in the light. But if you were only wild, and if you were only extreme, and if you were only addicted to this constant experience of transformation, you would risk madness or grandiosity or the most terrifying kind of cruelty or real delusion. And so that wildness has to be married in the core of your being with the most radical imaginable humility, with the kind of humility before the magnificence and the glory of the divine that keeps you always somewhere dazzled and bewildered and astounded and on your knees in a state of total adoration. And if you can marry that wildness and that humility at ever greater depths of richness and passion and sweetness and calm, then what you will find is that you will be able to negotiate the zigzags of the path with something like grace. And what I want to begin today by doing is just reading you out two poems that celebrate those two aspects, so that you can begin to marry them within yourself, and so that these two poems can run like jaguars of flame through everything that I want to say. The first poem is by Kabir, and it's called True Knowledge. If you don't know Kabir, you have a great good fortune awaiting you. Kabir is probably, with Rumi, the greatest of all the Sufi-inspired mystic poets. And he lived in Benares in the 15th century. He was a weaver. Both the Hindus and the Sufis claimed him because his realization was so immense. And if the truth be told, maybe it was one without name. But he wrote this poem, True Knowledge. This I've discovered is true knowledge. Those who scramble to get onto a boat sink like a stone midstream, while the shelterless and the abandoned reach the other shore. Those who dare to take the hard, winding, thorny road get to town in the end, but those who stroll the easy highway get robbed or even killed soon after they set out. Everybody is wound in illusion's web, the so-called holy as much as the worldly, and those who run for safety under the comforting dais of some form or some ritual or some dogma, well, life's hurricane will lash them. So stay out in the open. You'll be left safe and dry. The ones loved never savages live in boredom and pain, and those loved devours like a cannibal live in bliss forever. The ones who lose their own eyes come to see the whole creation blazing in their own light. And those who hold on to their own sight remain blind as bats in full noon. When I began to awake to truth, I saw how bizarre and crazy the world really is. Anything you cling to will be taken from you. And any agenda you adore will in the end be smashed. And any safety or dogma or ritual that you have used to protect yourself from the full glare, the full blare, the full agony and glory of reality will, if you progress on the path, be totally incinerated. So why not begin by taking the risk of staying out in the open, where paradoxically you'll be safest, and not in some shelter or some house where any old hurricane can rubble everything. And then, with that wildness in your brain, and with the paradox that that wildness makes available, please listen to this extraordinary meditation from Rumi's Table Talk. And this is something I can never read without trembling, because it is a meditation that warns and judges and admonishes us all at all times. And there is never a moment where you do not need to take its advice with total seriousness. And the meditation is called Be Always Humble. Remember always that all mystic sciences and exercises, all passions and acts of devotion, in comparison with the real worth and the real majesty of God, are as if someone came to you, bowed once, performed some perfunctory little service, and then went away. If you were to put the entire earth in service of God on your heart, it would be the same as bowing your head once to the ground. I am not trying to discourage you by saying this, only to instill in you some sense of proportion, some sense of the terrible glory of the one you love. Do you imagine that God's beauty and worth and magnanimity did not precede your worship and service of them? Wasn't it God that made you able to service and worship him? Wasn't it God who gave you some tiny spark of his great passion to love him with? Some tiny flame of his eternal fire of perseverance with which to go on looking for him? So who are any of us to boast of anything? Anything we can do, anything at all, is like making little forms out of wood and leather and taking them humbly to God, saying, I love these little forms, I made them, but it is up to you to give them life. Give them life, and these my works shall live. If you do not, everything is always up to you. Abraham said, God is he who gives life and he who makes to die. And Pharaoh said, I am he who gives life and makes to die. What arrogance. Because if God wants, the sun will rise in the west and the mountains will vanish like smoke at one rush of his wind, and all the seas will dissolve in vapor and all the stars fall out of the sky into a pit of eternal darkness. This is the power and this is the infinite majesty and this is the glory of the one we are in love with. Never forget this or you will be in danger. The path to him is littered with the bones of those who did not remember who they were looking for, and how great, beyond all concepts and all imagining, God always is. If you can marry this courageous, fearless wildness with that radical amazement, that radical awe, that radical wonder, that constant commitment to remain somewhere on your knees before the unutterable majesty and magnificence and glory of the divine. If you can marry those two, then something is born in you which says always yes to love, whatever the circumstances, that risks that huge yes, whatever the whirlwind you are in, whatever the darkness that surrounds you. And let us face it, in 2001, we are surrounded by whirlwinds of darkness. 2 billion people live on less than $1 a day. The environment is being degraded and murdered and destroyed by our greed and our ignorance. We have created vast problems of uneducated people with uneducated hearts, fed by the trash of a corrupt and manipulative media. We are living, in other words, in a situation that is potentially apocalyptic. And on the one hand, we have corrupt politicians who flatter us and feed their own greed and feed our greed and only tell us what our greed wants to hear. And on the other hand, we have a so-called spiritual movement that is almost as narcissistic as the culture that it is supposed to be transforming, that is obsessed with private visions, private revelations, and addicted to what I call a kind of virtual mysticism, which has about as much relationship to true transformative mysticism as Zsa Zsa Gabor has to acting or Madonna to singing. So this is an extremely dangerous situation. And when you wake up to it, and many of us are still in a coma of denial, many of us are still blanked out by the prevailing coma of this culture. Many of us don't want to wake up to what we know at 3 o'clock in the morning, that we are in a world which is visibly shrinking and visibly dying before us, in an unprecedented situation of unprecedented danger. Many of us don't want to wake up to that. But when you do, let me tell you that yes will be menaced and threatened from every side. You will see the corrupt politicians and the corrupt corporation leaders. You will see the people in coma who don't want to listen. You will see the corrupt gurus and the corrupt masters and the corrupt disciples who just want private fixes of some heroine of transcendence. You will see the whole situation, and a part of you will just fall to your knees in despair and rage and outrage and a grief that will tear yourself apart. But if you succumb to that grief, and if you succumb to that despair, and if you let the accuracy, so-called, of your perceptions blind you with tears of rage and anguish, then you will not be in the stream of the divine transformation. Because somehow, we all have to go on in the face of this gathering darkness, saying with our whole being and our whole life, an ever greater, ever richer, ever wilder, ever more profound, ever more transformative, yes, and offering our whole lives as a flame sign of that yes, so that others can find the courage to face what's going on and to really work with the whole divine order of their whole beings to do something real about it. And that is why I want to tell you the story that I'm now going to tell you. When I was 28, I was invited by the Israeli government to be among a group of intellectuals, a wilder group you couldn't imagine, actually. And we went, and we were taken around Israel and given all kinds of juicy propaganda, and it was great fun. And it was an eye-opener in so many ways to the madness of the Middle East. But there's one day that I remember particularly. It was a day in which I spent the whole day with a wonderful Hasidic scholar and poet. He looked like a frog and wore a Hawaiian shirt and told outrageous off-color jokes. But being in his presence was like being bathed by sweet fire. And we ended up that day standing together at dusk in the Garden of Olives, in the Garden of Gethsemane, looking across at the gate that is in the wall through which the Messiah is supposed to come through. And as he stretched out his hand to caress the outline of the gate in the air, I saw that on his arm were the numbers of the concentration camp. He saw me looking at the numbers, and he said, "I haven't wanted to talk of these things with you, but we have known each other for a wonderful day, so I can tell you something which I tell few people." And he told me about how he had spent the years 9 to 12 in Auschwitz, and how he had seen his father butchered, his mother raped and then butchered, and all his family humiliated, degraded, and butchered. How he had been raped and sodomized by a guard who then forced him to clean out a latrine with his tongue, and how he had been driven by the nightmare and the horror and the darkness and the squalor and the real potent evil of everything that was happening around him to dive very deep into himself and ask himself one essential question. Is the world that these maniacs creating, is that the real world? Is this all there really is when all the masks of propriety are stripped away? Or is the world that I feel at the bottom of the bottom of my heart, the world that is compounded of strange longings and memories of happiness with my mother and her singing me lullabies and her playing me Schubert and of my first visits to the synagogue when I first heard the words of God, read by an old man with tears in his eyes? Is that the real world? Which world is the real world? And for this boy in Auschwitz, that was not an academic question, because on his answer to it depended his capacity to survive what was being inflicted to him. And so he wrestled with this question, and he cried out to God, and he said to God again and again, night after night, "Reveal to me the true world. Reveal to me what is real. Reveal to me the nature of reality." And nothing happened. For month after month after month, the squalor continued and the evil continued and the banality of horror just went on and on, unfolding in its maniacal repetitiveness. And he grew more and more despairing and more lost, until one morning a truth dawned in his mind. And that truth was very simple, he told me. That truth was that God would not move towards him until he had really, in his own being, chosen until he had really in his own being made the choice for himself and as himself of which of those two worlds, the world that evil was creating around him or the world that lived in the core of his imagination, in the core of his heart, in the core of his yearning, in the core of his longing, in the core of his inner passion, which of those two was real? And he said that that was the wildest moment of his life because he realized that he had the power to initiate, if he wanted to, a relationship with that power that is all things, if in fact it existed. But the power rested on his choice. And you know what he did? He told me that he got up and it was very early morning. And he went into the middle of the square of snow and barbed wire in Auschwitz. And standing there silently, he screamed silently, "I choose love. I choose love. I choose love." And he screamed it. He said no sound could ever have approximated to that scream because every single cell of my body was screaming, "I choose love. I choose the world of the sacred imagination, of sacred passion, of sacred will, of sacred memory. I choose it, and I stake my whole being, my whole life, and everything I am on its permanent, unalterable, total reality." And he said when he finished, something amazing happened. The entire sky before him filled with blazing divine light. The light came on in everything and surrounded him. And even the icicles on the barbed wire of the camp were glittering like diamonds. And at that moment, the guard who had sodomized him and raped him and forced him to clean out the latrine with his tongue came out of a neighboring hut smoking a cigarette. And instead of feeling hatred, instead of feeling rage, instead of feeling fear, what he said he felt for the first time in his whole life, he'd never known what this feeling was until he felt it then, what he felt was a burning and aching agony of pity for someone who did not know that the only real world was the world that was blazing around him and informing all things and appearing as all things. It was an amazing moment. And then he turned to me and he said, "Remember," he said, "because you'll need to remember. Because humanity is entering its period of final trial in which it will have to decide between those two worlds, either the world of its darkness and greed or the world of its most sacred longing. And I have only one thing to say to you," he said finally. "Remember this, evil may have its triumph for a day, for a week, for a year, for 10 years, for 20 years, maybe even for a century. But love has already triumphed in a dimension evil does not know, cannot destroy, which lasts forever because it is divine." I have carried that story in me as a constant reminder of what I must do as I wake up to the horror of our time, as I wake up to the coma of our time, as I wake up to the fantastic sloth of our time, as I wake up to the great refusal of our time to see these problems, to feel these problems, and to begin to do anything about these problems. I keep that story as a constant reminder of what the true search is really about. The true search is about being wild and humble and giving birth to a yes that gets deeper and richer and wilder and more profound the darkness that is set against it. And once you really know that, nothing can stop you, nothing can swerve you from the path, and nothing can defeat you, because you are standing with your whole being in the direct flame of the direct presence. Now, I'd like to say something about the path itself. I think perhaps we should just all take a deep breath. I want to warn you first against the pseudo-mysticisms that are out there. And let me tell you how you can tell them. They will always flatter you and tell you you are already divine and don't have to do any work except attend some of the highly expensive intensives or get a special mantra from X guru or Y guru for some considerable fee. They will tell you that evil is not real. They will tell you that this world is just an illusion and it doesn't really matter if all of this gorgeous planet goes down into darkness, for we are really only spirit beings. And as such, the body is not real, and the screaming animals in the burning forests are just collateral damage, as Timothy McVeigh said about the children. Collateral damage. Collateral damage. And these pseudo-mysticisms are very, very popular at this moment because they drug us to the agony of what is happening, because they flatter us as everything else in this consumerist society flatters us, and because they take us away from what we secretly know to be true. And so therefore we cling to them with a passion because they absolve us of responsibility. I beg you to see their hollowness, their fantasy, their denial, their shabbiness, their cheapness, their unspeakable vulgarity. And I beg you not to be seduced by them. If you go to the great mystical traditions, and the Sufi is in many, many ways the most severe and rigorous and passionate of all with the Christian, you will see that the mark of authentic mysticism is the following. That it never says that the path is easy. It says it's glorious, but admits the suffering, the ordeals, the stripping, the dying that has to come. Authentic mysticism never denies the existence of evil. It says evil does not exist at the highest level of reality because there is just the one in all its absolute splendor. But at every single other level of reality, evil is extremely powerful and can do overwhelming damage to the work of the one as well as to the deep purpose of humanity. And that is extremely important to remember always, because if you do not know that there are dark forces in you and outside you that are threatening the future of your own search and of the entire planet, then you are a blind Cinderella wandering in a ball of vampires and wolves. And authentic mysticism has one other characteristic which you will notice by its total absence from the pseudo-virtual mysticisms being peddled in the marketplace like vanilla ice cream. And this characteristic is that it always stresses the fact that the path is undertaken not for your own private experience, not for the visions, not for the illuminations, not even for the powers that the one gives you, but for the one and for the one's work in humanity and as humanity and for humanity in the one. That the path does not end in becoming a lord and master, dominating other people with the splendor of your realization, which is all of our secret fantasy somewhere, isn't it? It does not end there. That is just the last hiding out place of the false self, which has to be destroyed totally if the real path is to begin. The path ends in the voluntary choosing of a lifetime of incessant, humble, passionate, wild, extreme service. And that is the authentic path. And if you really take those criteria, you will be able to tell the false from the true. Because what you need as well as the fusion of wildness and humility is what Jesus called so brilliantly and movingly the wisdom of the serpent with the innocence of the dove. You have to combine a shrewdness, which in its essence is as cynical as the cynicism of the most decadent and disillusioned worldling, with the innocence of the deer and the dove and the cat. You have to fuse both of them. If you're just innocent, you'll be led like sheep to slaughter. And if you're just wise like the serpent, you will never see the divine light. What you have to do is to, in a time like ours, when all the cheap versions are popular, and the real version is austere and hard to get to and hard to hear because very few people will risk telling it because they don't want to put people off. They want to be loved. They want to be followed. That, if you can hear that, what you need to grow is, above all, a very pure discrimination that really sees things as they are. So the map I'm going to give you is not the equivalent of one of those 17th century maps of the Amazon. Have you ever seen them? They're so sweet. There's the Amazon, which is only the wildest, most terrifying river in reality, painted a gorgeous, sweet marzipan red. And there are all kinds of little animals floating around. And it's the equivalent of all those writers who say, the path is just relaxing into your essential being, just opening up to the divine, and all will be done for you. All that gobbledygook and garbage, because it has no discipline, no passion, no sense of good and evil, nothing, except its own flattery of your false self's desire for comfort. Whereas, in fact, as you all know, the Amazon is not like that. The Amazon has rapids. The Amazon has rocks. The Amazon has waterfalls. The Amazon has tribes of extremely nasty, un-Margaret Mead-like natives with curare-tipped weapons who will be delighted at certain stages of your path to see you like a pincushion with each one of them. And unless you are warned about these dangers, unless these dangers are made clear to you by somebody who really wants you to have the full experience and not a minor diluted experience, then you are like somebody setting out to climb Mount Everest in a tutu with a bag of chips. So, let's get to the meat of it. The glorious good news is, of course, and all the mystical traditions tell us, is that we contain within us, as our deepest identity, a spark of divine consciousness, which nothing can destroy. So we come into this experience with what could be called an original blessing. The blessing of an original glory, the blessing of a divine consciousness which is hidden deep within us. And that blessing in the Sufi mystical context is always described as the blessing that streams from the pact of Alast, the pact when before space and time the souls of all things that were to be created were called upon to witness the Lord and all said yes. And the whole point of the path for the Sufi is to uncover that primordial yes that is absolutely the same as the divine consciousness and have it become the conscious ruler of all your emotions, all your thoughts, all your ideas, your whole body and your whole life. But as you can see, even from that brief description, that is an overwhelmingly difficult enterprise. Because, as the Sufis say, our original blessing is covered by 100,000 veils of illusion, all of which have to be burnt away before that primordial yes can flash out from the depths of our being, that choice of divine love can become our normal reality. But the good news is also this. If the light has come down all these different levels to incarnate in matter as us, then there must be a route back that is encoded in our genes, in our psyche, in our minds, in our hearts, as surely as our DNA is encoded. And in fact, this has been the living experience of all the mystical traditions. Their living experience has been just as the light infolds in us to be incarnate in matter, so through taking the path, we unfold it station by station by station by station, going back up to origin by the very steps that origin came down to us. Knowing this and being certain of this and uncovering this with joy on the path initiates you into another great joyful secret. And this great joyful secret you will meditate on a lot. And every time you will meditate on it, you'll draw from it another kind of strength. And this secret simply is that if the light has unfolded in us to be unfolded in us, then the whole path, however weird it may seem to the mind, however extravagant it may seem to the heart, however testing, however crazy, however bewildering it seems to any kind of reason, is in its nature and its unfolding wholly natural. It is as natural in its divine dimension as the growth of that flower is in its natural dimension. And one day we will have a human race, if we survive the next 20 years, which will understand and innerstand that the mystical traditions represent inner sciences, as exact, as precise, as lucid, as completely sober-minded and based on real experiment as the outer sciences. And the world will accept that just as a rose bush grows by stages in a garden, so the divine human rose, a full divine human consciousness, grows by very definite stages, all of which have to be undergone and completed if the full rose is to open fully on a fully developed stem with the right amount of protective thorns. Very important. Am I making myself clear?
Yes.
This is very important to understand, because as the path gets wilder, you will be tempted to believe that what is happening to you is supernatural, surreal, utterly out of this world. No, my friends, it is the reason for which this world was created, so you could have the experience of becoming a full divine human rose through the natural progression of the various stages. Now, there is another crucial piece of information which most of the maps out there really do not have, which is, in fact, destroys their claim to seriousness from the beginning. And that is the distinction which the Sufis make magisterially, and it is one of their most important contributions to mystical thought, between what they call states and what they call stations. States are dreams or visions or illuminations or extraordinary insights or sudden initiations into the real that come, flash, blaze, and then go. Stations are totally different. Stations are achieved and permanent normal levels of awareness that have been achieved through prayer and meditation and concentration and loving contemplation and real service. States are what happened between the steps back to origin, and stations are the steps back to origin. And you can't leap from step one to step three. You have to go through step two. And that is the clue to the progression of the path. And knowing what the stations are is a clue to knowing where you are and what you still have to do. And if you don't have this kind of knowledge, if you don't risk having this kind of knowledge, because it's extremely unflattering to the full self and terribly miserable to the ego and very, very shaming to the spiritual conquistador in every single one of us, if we don't have this knowledge, we risk making the whole path a massive ego trip, another excuse for us to dominate, impress, seduce, and manipulate other people, and not a celebration of our innate divine presence at all. And just as there is virtual mysticism out there, so there are virtual mystics out there who can talk a blue streak about all the different experiences, but who haven't gone through methodically the different stations and who don't know where they are and therefore are the blind leading the blind. And that is a very dangerous situation. So what I'm going to try and do now is to open up for you the grandeur and the difficulty of these stations. And I'm going to do both because having a real map, how you can tell you have a real map is that it simultaneously profoundly humbles you and profoundly exalts you. It humbles you because you find out where you really are, which is always humbling, and it exalts you because you also begin to imagine where you could be if you loved enough and prayed enough and served enough and gave enough and fought enough. So, I believe that the map looks something like this. We come here trailing clouds of glory, but deeply forgetful of our origin. And many of us have extraordinary visionary experiences in childhood. And I bet my bottom 2 cents that everyone in this room, if they really thought about their childhood, can remember moments of extraordinary awe, moments of union with reality, moments of very, very wide and spacious love. But it's extremely important to be very clear, this is not, under any circumstances, real awakening, for the simple reason that it is not self-conscious. It does not know the depth and the grandeur of what it is experiencing. And for that self-consciousness to be present in an individual, there has to be first the development of an ego and then its conscious transcendence. So the development of the ego, or of what we call the full self, that starts to happen between 9 and 12 is not a fall from grace. It is the growth, if you like, of the stem of the rose, which is going to hold the branches that will one miraculous day hold the bud and then the full open rose. However, as soon as you say that, you come across the first set of dangers. And the first set of dangers are these. The ego, as it grows, forms itself in a series of Pavlovian reactions to its parents, to the society around it, through what it's being talked to about God in church, to the social expectation of its peers. Almost immediately, as it starts to form, it forms around a completely false sense of identity that is addicted to success and power and looking good and being loved and accepted. And that, in a culture like ours, can be the fate of almost everybody in that culture, because this is the most desacralized culture, the most addicted to the false self that any human society has ever produced. So you can stay in this infantile fixation on power, money, sex, and success, and on the manifestation of your desire for the whole of your life, and have it totally justified by all the powers that govern our world. And that's the tremendous danger at this moment, because unless the agendas of the false self are shattered in some profound way, the imprisoned soul, the imprisoned divine consciousness, never becomes conscious of itself and never goes through what is necessary to realize itself. There is some good news, however, which is that God is even stronger than capitalism. God is stronger than Madonna. God is stronger than Larry King. God is stronger than MTV. God is stronger than CNN. And God is stronger than all the lies of our world that pervert us and swerve us from the glory of our origin. And what usually happens to modern seekers is that there comes a time when all of their carefully prepared agendas, when all of their carefully prepared games, when all of their desires to please and to be flattered and to love and to succeed are rubbled by a disaster, a bankruptcy, or a falling love affair, or a strange bout of depression, or the death of a parent, something that comes to reveal to us the total emptiness of a world without meaning. And my devout prayer for everybody is that they have a not totally severe and not totally fatal nervous breakdown as young as possible. Because if you have it young, then you can really do the work of climbing out of the false self through the grace of God. If it comes older, in your 30s or 40s, or God help you, in your 50s, then what you have already around you is a lifetime of coma, a lifetime of bad habits, a lifetime of falsely cheering yourself up with false solutions, so that the real work of climbing up from the false self into the radiance of the true self is very much more difficult, and all those voices of no, all those voices of discouragement are very, very much harder to bear.